Morning, Dr. Vinegar.
Good morning. Okay, so I'm sorry about last Friday. I didn't get the projector working. After class, I figured out how to turn it on. Even the recorded version was not so great. So what I did is on Canvas, I posted my 9:30 lecture for Friday rather than the one we did in class. I think we got things working again today. Let's see, a couple administrative things. First of all, homework assignment 2 is due today. And then I've also assigned homework set, WebAssign home problem set 3. That will be due a week from today. And then coming up, we're just about through with the material that's going to be covered on the first exam. Introduce vectors, matrices, solving linear equations. I'll talk about finding the inverse of a matrix. That will probably be on Wednesday in Friday's lecture. And then generally, because takes some time for me to lecture and then also to assign homework and have you do homework problems, you're not likely, even though we'll have covered the material that will be on the first exam by the end of this week, it probably will not be until 2 weeks from it, earliest possible, I think, would be 2 weeks from today for the midterm. So that will give us time not only to get through all the material, but also to review in class. And typically, the way what I do is the class meeting before the exam, I dedicate to a review session. And depending on how we schedule an exam, I may move forward on the material, but it won't be covered on the exam. So once I get past inverses of matrices, if there's more than one class meeting before the exam, then I'll just go on to new material. But I'll still save that review for the first exam to just before the first exam. Okay, so what I want to do today is I want to finish up our discussion about how we solve linear systems using row reduction and augmented matrices. So what I've concentrated on so far is this process of row reduction, how you take a matrix and you convert it into its reduced row echelon form. That reduced row echelon form, when the augmented matrix is in that form, it's going to correspond to the solution of the linear system. And what remains is to convert back to equations and then realize the solution set as a hyperplane, as a geometric object rather than values for the particular variables. So that's going to be the topic of today's lecture. So I'll remind you of how we solve systems, and then we're going to focus on this last step in the process where we take a matrix in reduced row echelon form, the augmented matrix, and we realize the solution set as a hyperplane. And we'll do lots of examples as well. The purpose of the examples, this part you'll see is pretty easy. It just requires some explanation. But in the examples, we'll concentrate mostly on this process of row reduction. Okay, so the method we're following is we take a linear system, a system of linear equations, and we attach to that a certain matrix. A matrix was actually split into two. This first factor here on the left-hand side is the coefficients, collection of all the coefficients that occur in the linear system. And that last column of this augmented matrix corresponds to the numbers on the right-hand side. The way we solve linear systems is we systematically convert this augmented matrix to a new form, the so-called reduced row echelon form. Now, the way we convert it is we perform operations on the augmented matrix that are equivalent to doing operations on the original set of equations that don't change the solution. And the idea, if we were working only with equations would be to take the original equations, systematically manipulate them until we got the equations of the solution. But the augmented matrix method is much, much more efficient. And so we use augmented matrices and we manipulate that rather than the equations themselves. Once we get to the augmented matrix in reduced echelon form, we convert back to the equations. That will give us the equations of the solution. And then the final step that has not yet been explained is how to express that solution set as a geometric object, maybe a single point, maybe a line, maybe a two-dimensional plane, or a high-dimensional analog of that, so-called hyperplane. All right, so we've covered up to about step three we've gone through. And so let's quickly review what we know so far. Take a system of linear equations. You can attach to that an augmented matrix. And if you have an augmented matrix, you can write down the corresponding linear system fairly easily. Thing to note is that each column on this coefficient side of the augmented matrix corresponds to a particular variable. This first column, it consists of all the coefficients of x1 in each of the n equations of the original linear system. And to go from the augmented matrix to the original equations, you just take a11 times the associated variable x1, a12 times x2, a13 times x3, et cetera. And you can easily write down the original system of equations. All right, and then what we're going to do once we convert to the augmented matrix is, rather than work with the equations further, we'll work directly with the augmented matrix using so-called elementary row operations. There'll be things like interchanging the order of the equations, but in this case, it will be interchanging the rows of this augmented matrix, or multiplying an equation by a number. It would just be scalar multiplying a particular row vector by a number, or adding a multiple of one equation to another. That's going to be implemented by adding a multiple of a row to another, or replacing a row by its sum with a multiple of another row. And then now we come to the new part. And the first thing I need to explain, so we're eventually going to convert to hyperplanes. But one thing to explain is the distinction we'll make between our variables, fixed variables versus free variables. So when you have fewer equations than you have knowns, you're not going to have enough restrictions on your variables to get a unique solution. You'll generally get infinitely many solutions. But what in fact happens is you're able to express some of the variables in terms of other variables. The variables that you use to express the other variables are called free variables, and the variables that are expressed in terms of the free variables are called fixed variables. Let me give you an explicit example. Here we have a single equation and two unknowns. If I solve for y, I've got y expressed as a function of x. And so once I know, this equation tells me that once I know what x is, y is determined. The way I'll interpret this is I'll interpret x as a free variable in the solution and y as a fixed variable. It's fixed by the value of x because the equation is true. But on the other hand, I can also derive this equation from the original equation, but I'll interpret the variables differently. Now I'm solving for x in terms of y, so I'll regard x as the fixed variable. It's being fixed by the value of the free variable y. All right, now this is common whenever we have systems of equations. How we solve a linear system, we have to decide what are we going to regard as a free variable and what's going to be regarded as a fixed variable. In this instance, it looks like we have a choice. But what's nice about the row reduction method is it leads to a consistent and natural choice of what you regard as free variables and what you regard as fixed variables fixed variables. Okay, so here's the way we do it. In our linear algebraic technique, we take an augmented matrix and row reduce it to its reduced row echelon form. Now, what happens when you have a matrix in row echelon form is that they, in reduced row echelon form, is that a given column, if it has a pivot, it has to be one, and it can be the only entry in that column. And so there are going to be certain entries of the matrix in reduced row echelon form that have pivots. Those we're going to associate with free variables. And the columns that do not have pivots are going to be associated, the fixed variables are going to be the columns that contain pivots, and the free variables are going to be the columns of the augmented matrix that do not contain pivots. This will become clear on the slide where you have a visual example. Here's an augmented matrix. Here are the pivots, one in the first row in the first slot, second row in the third slot, and the third row in the fifth slot. So according to what I said on the last slide, since columns 1, 3, and 5 contain pivot, we're going to interpret the corresponding variables, x1, x3, and x5, as being fixed variables in our solution. The columns that do not have pivots, notice this second column, it has non-zero numbers there, but they don't appear as the first non-zero number in the row. And so this column doesn't have a pivot, nor does the fourth column have a pivot. So in our interpretation of the solution, we're going to use x1, x3, and x5 as the fixed variables. And since we have no pivots in the second and fourth column, we're going to regard x2 and x4 as free variables. All right, so let me do that, and I'll show you why this works well for us. Here's the same augmented matrix. I'm just going to read off from the form of the augmented matrix the corresponding set of equations. 1 times x1, 2 times x2, 0 times x3, minus 1 times x4, 0 times x5 is equal to 1. That's how we got the first equation. Similarly, I can read across the second and third rows of the augmented matrix to get two more equations. Now, this is where we come, where the interpretation of variables as being either fixed or free has come in. If you look at this first equation, there's only one fixed variable, right? Because there's only one pivot in any given row. And so here's our fixed variable. What I'm going to do is I'm going to move the free variables to the right-hand side of the equation. Similar in the second row, x4 is the free variable. I'm going to move it to the right-hand side. And x5 doesn't involve any variables. x5 has to equal 3. And so when we move the free variables to the right-hand side, what happens is you see that the fixed variables, x1, x4, and x5, are now expressed in terms of the free variables. And that's generally the way, it's generally the way you would write a solution set of a linear system, expressing the variables that you can express in terms of free variables, you do so, and the variables that are left undetermined, you put on the right-hand side of the equation. Okay, so making the distinction between free and fixed variables by distinguishing between columns that have pivots and columns that don't have pivots, that's what allows us to write down the solution in this manner. It helps us to decide what we regard as free. If I didn't look at that augmented matrix, well, there's not a clear choice as to which of these three variables I should regard as fixed and which I regard as free. It's by reference to the augmented matrix in reduced row echelon form that we make that decision. All right, and then once we've written down, once we've identified the values of the fixed variables, we can now use that to actually formulate the hyperplane expression for the entire solution set. All right, so what I'm going to do is, first of all, I'm going to write down a generic five-dimensional vector. But now I'm going to use the equations of our solution. They now are expressing the fixed variables in terms of the free variables. I'll substitute where I can in this vector. So x1 on the previous slide was equal to 1 minus 2x2 minus x4. And so I'll substitute for x1 its expression in terms of the free variables. X2 is a free variable, so I leave it alone. X3 can be expressed in terms of x4, so I make that substitution. X4 is a free variable, I leave it alone. And x5 was seen to have to equal 3 if the equation is satisfied. All right, now what we have is a solution vector that's completely determined by the values of x2 and x4. We're getting close to the hyperplane solution. At least now we're realizing the solution as a vector rather than concentrating on the individual values of the variables. Okay, so I'm going to, I've expressed the solution vectors in terms of the free variables. The last step is to take this vector expression for the solution and rip it apart. We're going to look at the constant terms that appear in each component and how the free variables appear in each component. So these constant terms I'm going to pull off in a single initial vector, and then I'm going to have terms in each component that are proportional to x2. I'll grab those and put them in a single vector, and then there'll be terms that involve x4. I'll grab those and put them in a single vector. So I've taken my solution vector and I've ripped it apart depending on how it depended on the free variables. And then because the second vector is apparently x2 times this constant vector, this last vector is x4, scalar multiplying this constant vector. And now we've reached my goal. Now you may not recognize it, but this expresses a solution vector as a point plus an arbitrary number. X2 is a free parameter, so it could be anything at all, and it would still produce a legitimate solution. So we have a point plus some number times one vector and another number times a different vector. That means we got a hyperplane. The first week of class, we talked about hyperplanes as sets of vectors that we can form by picking a starting point and then straying from that starting point in a given list of directions, in this case, v1 and v2. We vary these numbers, t1 and t2, so that we actually fill out an entire plane by varying just two parameters. This expression has this form. The correlation would be this constant vector p0, if that constant vector there, this constant vector v1 corresponds to this constant vector. And this parameter that we vary, well, it corresponds to our ability to vary the free parameter x2. And the second parameter that we can vary in constructing this hyperplane, it corresponds to our ability to vary the free parameter x4. So indeed, this expression here expresses all the points on the of the solution as lying on a particular hyperplane. A hyperplane that's specified by these three vectors. Okay, so that's the goal. That's the goal. And I guess I'll quickly review this, and then what I'm going to do for the rest of today's lecture is just work out examples. Okay, so how do we go from the augmented matrix to the hyperplane? First of all, we look at the augmented matrix in reduced to echelon form, and we decide what variables are going to be fixed and what variables are going to be free. The variables that correspond to columns of the augmented matrix that have pivots, those are going to be the variables you can solve for in terms of the free parameters, the so-called fixed variables. And then the variables that correspond to columns of the augmented matrix that do not have pivots, those are going to be the free parameters in the solution, or the free variables. All right, and then we write down the equations. Once we got the equations written down, we systematically move all the free variables from the left-hand side where they first appear over to the right-hand side, leaving the fixed variables stuck on the left-hand side. Then we write down a solution vector using the equations we got in this step to replace the fixed variables by their expressions in terms of the free variables. And the last step is to write down a solution vector where you substitute for the fixed variables in terms of the free parameters, and you expand that solution vector in terms of the free parameters. All right, so verbally, when I write it down, it doesn't look like it that obvious what's actually going on. It'll become more obvious when we just do one example. Okay, and in fact, in this example, I'm going to show you not just how to carry out the method, but what happens when, in fact, our system of equations are not independent of one another, that maybe there's some connection between these equations. So if you remember in our initial discussion about solving linear equations, the naive expectation that you get simply on from your understanding of high school algebra, if you have five equations and four unknowns, well, let me do a different example. I have five unknowns and three equations. Each equation could be used to eliminate one variable, and so your solution set would be 5 minus 3, or a two-dimensional solution set. Well, that's true only when the equations are actually independent of one another. If these two equations actually imply the third equation, then imposing the third equation doesn't put any new restriction on the variables, and so the actual set of independent equations is going to be smaller than your original list of equations. The right way to count the size of the solution set is to take the number of variables and subtract the number of independent equations. But when you're given a linear system, it's not always easy to see that, in fact, there's two equations might imply the third. What I'm going to show you is how the row reduction technique brings that information out, makes it obvious. All right, so here I'm just repeating what I said already. If I had three equations and three unknowns, you would expect a zero-dimensional solution. A zero-dimensional solution does not mean that there's no solution. But rather what it means is that the solution is zero dimensional, and so it consists of a single point. All right, now, let's just apply our technique for solving linear systems using augmented matrices. I take the system of equations, and I convert each equation to a row of the augmented matrix. Then I begin to apply my row reduction. The goal now is to get to the augmented matrix of the solution. All right, this 3x4 matrix is not in row echelon form. Row echelon form means the pivot entries, whatever they are, they have to be occurring in a sort of downward staircase as you move from left to right in this matrix. The pivot should be dropping steadily down. They never change direction and appear off to the left of the pivot in the row above it. So if we're going to get a matrix in row echelon form, the first thing I have to do is get rid of these pivots that are sitting directly below the pivot in the first row. Well, we have a row operation that will do that for us pretty easily. What we try to do is take a multiple of this row, add it to one of these lower rows so that these leading entries exactly cancel. So to get rid of this guy, what I'll do is I'll subtract the first row from the second row and use that as a replacement for the second row. And to get rid of this number 3 in the first column here, what I'll do is I'll take 3 times the first row, that will give a component 3 up there, and I'll subtract it from the third row, and I'll use that to replace the third row. So I'll do maybe this operation. 1 minus 1 is 0. Minus 1 minus 1 is negative 2. 1 minus 1 is 0, and 0 minus 2 is negative 2. So these can be formed really rapidly. You just need to figure out the pivot you want to use to eliminate the pivots that are below it, and then all you have to do is multiply your pivot row by an appropriate scalar factor so you can get the desired cancellation. All right, now I end up with a matrix that is not yet in row echelon form, because up to the second row it is in row echelon form, but this third row, it has a pivot directly below the pivot in the second row. And I need to move the pivot in the third row off to the right. So I'll try to cancel this thing out by adding a multiple of the second row to the third row. And what happens in this instance is that the second and third row exactly cancel. All right, now, getting a little bit ahead of ourselves, let me look at the equation that corresponds to this last row. It says 0 times x1 plus 0 times x2 plus 0 times x3 is equal to 0. Well, left-hand side simplifies to 0. And so one of the equations of the system is equivalent to just saying 0 is equal to 0, which is not putting any restriction at all on our variables. These row operations are not changing the solution at all. So in fact, what these row operations have done so far has revealed that there's a triviality in the original system of equations. Where the real restriction on the variables come from is from these first two rows. This last row in the augmented matrix is not saying anything mathematically, except an identity that 0 happens to equal 0. Doesn't put any restrictions on the variables. What happened is we used operations that may simplify the equations, but we did not change the solution set. And what we found is that one of our equations, somewhere amongst our equation, was a triviality that could be removed. All right, so in other words, we started off with three equations and three unknowns, and we see that that effectively has the same solution set as two equations and three unknowns. All right, and in that way, the redundancy amongst the original equations was exposed. All right, so let's continue. We're gonna keep going until we reach reduced echelon form. The distinction we now want to impose on this matrix is that the pivots have to equal 1. That's the first condition. And the second condition is that above and below pivots, I should have nothing but zeros. Well, getting it into row echelon form, we've already got zeros sitting below the pivots. Here's our problem. Non-zero entries that sit above pivots. So we'll fix the pivot first by multiplying this row by minus 1/2. That gets the pivot equal to 1. And then the last thing we need to do is to get rid of this entry above the pivot. So let me remind you, reduce row echelon form means three things. It means it's in row echelon form. It means pivots have all been normalized to 1. And it means above and below pivots, only zeros occur. And so what prevents this matrix from being in reduced row echelon form is the appearance of this non-zero number above the pivot in the second row. But it's easy to get rid of this guy. We just take a multiple of the second row, we add it to the first row, and we'll get the desired cancellation. So we simply send the first row to its difference with the second row. And now Using just elementary row operations, we recast the original augmented matrix into reduced row echelon form. This matrix is unique. For a given, if you start off with a given matrix, there's only one matrix in reduced row echelon form. You may have many different ways of reaching that final form, but that destination is unique. Okay, so this, in fact, is what we'll interpret as the augmented matrix of the solution. All right, now, having reached the augmented matrix of the solution, we convert back to equations. Here it is. First, this augmented matrix says, well, here it's written out in full glory, multiplying each entry in the row times the corresponding variable and then setting it equal to the number on the right-hand side. But this system simplifies to x1 plus x3 is equal to 1, x2 is equal to 1, and the last row simply says 0 is equal to 0. So I really only have two equations on my three unknowns. What we'll now do is we'll make the distinction between fixed variables and free variables so that we can proceed to get that hyperplane solution. Okay, let's look at this matrix. We have a pivot in the first column, so x1 should be regarded as a fixed variable. A pivot in the second column, x2 is going to be regarded as fixed. No pivot in the third column. We have a non-zero entry, but it's not the first non-zero entry, so it's not a pivot. So x3, corresponding to a column without a pivot, is going to be interpreted as a free variable in the solution. Right, and now from this matrix, we interpret x1 and x2 as fixed, x3 as free, and we simply take the free variables coming from the equations attached to this augmented matrix. We simply move the free variables to the right-hand side. And now each of our fixed variables is expressed in terms of either a constant or a constant in the free variable. And we can write down a typical solution vector, substituting where we can for the fixed variables. So x1 was equal to 1 minus the free variable x3, x2 is equal to the constant 1, and x3 is a free variable, so we leave it alone. And the last step is to stare at this vector and see how we can rip it apart, sort of expanding it in terms of powers, well, not even powers, it's just linear terms in the variables. So this vector here can be thought of as a piece that does not depend on any variables at all, one, one, and no dependence on the, on no constant in the third one, so it's one, one, zero. Then we have terms that involve x3, it's going to be minus one in the first component, and no x3 in the second component, but 1 times x3 in the third component. And we've got our solution. And in fact, it's expressed as a line. It's a single point. And then we stray from that point an arbitrary amount, x3 in the first line. But here I just call that parameter t in the second line. I create a geometric line by starting in a point, departing from that point along a particular distance, along a particular direction, but an arbitrary distance along that direction. And it generates a line. What we're effectively doing here is constructing a line. Right, let me get a coordinate system here. By plotting a point, that would be my P0, choosing a direction, D, and then straying from that point one way or the opposite way along that particular direction, and that will fill out the entire infinite line. Okay, and so there we have it. We had a system of three equations and three unknowns. Our row reduction process exposed that we really only had two independent equations, and so three variables minus two independent equations. Now, 3 minus 2 is 1, so we should expect a one-dimensional solution, and in fact, there it is. It's a line. Okay, so that's how it works out in this case. me do another example where another problem, so to speak, within a linear system becomes apparent. When I was talking geometrically about solutions of linear systems, I phrased it at every equation corresponds to a certain hyperplane. If we have, in fact, the dimension of that hyperplane is one less than the number of variables you have, because you can think of it as using the equation to re-express one of the variables in terms of the others. So if I have 10 equations, or if I have one equation and 10 unknowns, my solution space should be a nine-dimensional hyperplane sitting inside a 10-dimensional space of variables. Well, in that interpretation, one thing that's possible geometrically is to have two equations that are parallel, or two hyperplanes that are parallel to one another and never intersect. That's going to happen whenever your equations contain an internal contradiction. Here's how that situation, what it looks like when we're doing the row reduction process. All right, so I've set up this example so that it has a contradiction. Let me show you how I constructed this example. I took the first two equations and I subtracted one from the other and I get a new equation. So the first two equations actually imply this third equation. So if we didn't have that, this would not be any new information because it uses the information of the first two equations to produce this equation. But when I add in this third equation, you see it conflicts with the equation I derived from the first two. The first two are telling me that y minus 2z is equal to 1. The last equation says y minus 2z is equal to 4. Well, these cannot both be simultaneously true because 4 equals y minus 2z does not equal 1. Okay, so I've constructed a set of equations for which I know there's no solution. Let's see how that is exposed when I just naively apply our linear algebraic technique for solving linear equations. You write down the augmented matrix corresponding to this linear system, and we start row reducing. So the first step is to get rid of this pivot below the pivot in the first column. That's done with that row operation. And then we have a pivot below a pivot, and we'll do another elementary row operation to clear out that entry. So we'll subtract the third row, subtract the second row from the third. And now we end up with this augmented matrix. Let me convert back to equations to show you what's going on. That third row, when I write it down, the corresponding equations, I get 0 times x1 plus 0 times x2 plus 0 times x3 is equal to 3. Well, this side evaluates to 0. On the other side, we have 3. So the equation that corresponds to this last row is contradictory, unless you figure out some system of mathematics where 0 is equal to 3, it's gonna be contradictory. And so what you do when you uncover a phenomena like this in your row reductions, you stop, because this in fact tells you that there is no solution to your original linear system. Somehow your equations have an internal contradiction that cannot be resolved, and so there's no solution. What's striking, though, is that when you look at the original linear system, is you don't see that contradiction. Rather, it's been exposed by our process of row reduction. What the row reduction is doing, sort of intuitively, it's we're acting on the augmented matrix, but the augmented matrix always corresponds to systems of equations. We're systematically manipulating the augmented matrix so that the corresponding equations are getting simpler and simpler. And here they got so simple that we actually saw explicitly the contradiction that was contained in the original equations. All right. So in general, during the process of row reduction, you can have zero rows that appear. When a zero row appears, it means somewhere in your original set of equations, you had some redundancies and that you had more equations than you actually needed to find the complete solution. But that's okay. If that happens, it just means you have fewer rows where the action is actually going on. But a zero row doesn't mean there's no solution. It just means that one of your original equations that was actually redundant information rather than a further restriction on your variables. But if a pivot appears in that last column, if you have a row where on the other side of this dividing line, you have a non-zero number, this means that somewhere in your original set of equations, there was a contradiction. And if you find a pivot, see, this is the first non-zero entry in this last row. If you have a pivot in the last column, it means your original system was contradictory and there was no solution at all. So, and that's the way that row reduction is going to expose the redundancies amongst your equations and your hidden contradictions. But it also, since it exposes that those two phenomena, it also allows you to detect right away the dimension of your solution set. Because effectively, as long as you don't have zero rows like this and you've got it in row echelon form, the equations, that the rows that do survive as non-zero rows of the matrix in reducible echelon form, those non-zero rows are going to correspond to independent equations. So you can get your dimension of the solution set by simply taking a number of variables and subtracting the number of non-zero rows in the reducible echelon form. Okay, so let me step through this program, how we solve linear system via row reduction. We take a linear system, we write down an augmented matrix, and then we use these three elementary row operations to systematically convert it first to row echelon form. That's clearing out the entries below pivots, and then we convert it to reducible echelon form by forcing the pivots to all equal one, and then clearing out the entries that sit above pivots. And just using these three operations. So here's a matrix in row echelon form. These asterisks here means it could be any number you want. As long as the pivots are occurring in this downward staircase from the upper left to the lower right, you'll be in row echelon form. To get it in reducible echelon form, you use this operation, multiplying rows by a constant factor to renormalize these entries, these pivot entries, so that they actually have value one. Notice, however, that this operation does not change the position of the pivots in the matrix. They're staying in the same location, it's just that their value is being readjusted. And then once you've got the pivots renormalized to have value one, your next objective is to get rid of the entries that sit above pivots, and you use this operation. Use lower rows, use these pivots to clear out the entries above it. I should point out that there's another distinction to be made here. The process by which you reach row echelon form, the idea is you start up in this upper left-hand corner, remove all the entries below that leading pivot, then you move down to a lower row and you clear out the entries above. So you start in this upper left-hand corner and you systematically work your way down and off to the right. The process by which the matrix in row echelon form is converted to reducible echelon form, after you renormalize the pivots, you're working upwards. And so you start in the lower right-hand corner, clear out these entries, then you move to the next pivot in an upper row, or actually the next row, the next pivot to the left, you work with that guy and you use that to clear out the entries there. And then you move here and use that to clear out the entries here. So the first half of your row reduction, you're moving from upper left to lower right. In the second half, you're moving from lower right up to towards the upper left. But you follow that pattern, you'll systematically convert an arbitrary matrix into its unique row, you know, reduced row echelon form. All right, and then once we reach reduced row echelon form, we decide what variables we're going to interpret as fixed variables, the variables that we can express in terms of the free variables, and the free variables themselves. Fixed variables, look for the columns that have pivots. Free variables are the columns that do not have pivots. All right, so here's an example. Matrix in reduced row echelon form, you have your pivot variables. I've underlined them, x2, x3, and x5. I guess are my free variables, or so, fixed variables, corresponding columns with pivots. See this column here? Most common mistake on the first exam. There's no variables here. In fact, x1 does not appear in any of the equations. So do we forget about x1? No. It remains a free variable in the solution. We'll still take each row of this augmented matrix, and we'll convert it to equations, and we'll still move the free variables over to the right-hand side, but we don't forget about x1. It hasn't appeared yet, but on the next slide, it will appear. We want to write down the solution vector. Well, there's no equation in determining x1, so I'm going to leave it as a free variable. There is an equation determining x2, x3, and x5. So I'll use those equations to replace the fixed variables x2, x3, and x5 in terms of the free variables x4, x6, and, well, don't need it, but x1 is also a free variable. Now I've got my solution vector expressed in terms of the free variables. What remains is to expand this solution vector in terms of the free variables. Here's the constant term, 3, 2, 1. There are terms proportional to x1. In the first component, that's the only place it occurs, so we get this simple vector there. X4 appears in three different components. That's coefficient minus 2 in the second component, coefficient minus 1 in the third component, and coefficient 1 in the fourth component. And similarly, you can see the dependence on x6. And now we've got a typical solution vector expressed on a point on a three-dimensional hyperplane. See, we have three different ways we can stray from this point. And each of these vectors is a six-dimensional vector. So in fact, our solution set is a three-dimensional hyperplane embedded in a six-dimensional space, the six-dimensional space of variables. Okay, now let's see. Oh, I'm about out of time. I have two more examples on the slide, but I don't think I'll go through them. You can look at those yourself. And you should be looking at the homework problems as well. And that will give you practice. The thing that you really need to become efficient at is this process of row reduction. Because what you'll see is we not only use it to find solutions of equations, but we use it over and over again in other aspects of this course.